Well, it kind of feels like the middle of summer this week, doesn't it? We have high temperatures. We got humidity throughout much of the state. Actually, we're in a big transition point weather-wise, and that means a lot of activity in the natural world, including among the insects in our world. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Phil Pelletieri, an entomologist and head of the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab, our guest, the UW Extension entomologist. And Phil, great to have you back.
Nice to be here.
Really appreciate you taking the time for us. This is kind of a transition time, and it's that time of the year when we get ready for the box elder bug invasion.
Yeah, typically what I predict is a very dry late summer means lots of box elder bugs, so I'm getting nervous. And of course, last year was very dynamic because they even had an extra generation. And so we'll wait and see. I've not had any indications they've started yet, but it would not surprise me in the next week or two that they'll start those congregations and clustering on sunny sides of buildings.
Why are they so active in late summer?
Well, they're looking for hibernation sites, and that's just their behavior. So they're done feeding, done breeding, and they are a foul-tasting animal, so they cling together so that basically there's protection in numbers. And the normal thing that controls them is a fungus disease. And that needs moisture. And that's why for dry years, you get the counterpoint to it is that the populations aren't under control.
Do they cause problems or is it more just a nuisance?
Yeah, just a nuisance. But what's frustrating is once they get in the walls or the attic, you pay for it for the next 6 months and there's not a whole lot that can be done. So that's why this early September time is if you've had a tradition of having trouble, that's the time to try to stop them before they get in.
And are there good and safe ways to deter them, get rid of them?
Yeah, we've talked before about the soapy water as a contact spray, although still one of my favorite stories to tell is, my colleague at Iowa State always told me a half a cup of Tide laundry detergent. We were doing the show here about, it's got to be 15, 20 years ago now, and somebody said we tried Cheer and it didn't work. The problem is you don't know what's in the soap, and that's why it really is better to buy the insecticidal soap you find at the garden store because we know that's the right stuff.
Phil Pelletieri, our guest, you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Brian in Whitehall, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yeah, hi, guys. First of all, a compliment to Phil. I've been listening to Wisconsin Public Radio for nigh on 30 years, and every time I've heard you, very seldom have I ever heard you be stumped on a question, so congrats to you. My question today is, I think they're bees, the ones that hover around picnics and garbage cans and whatnot this time of year looking for sugar?
No, they're wasps.
Bees, they are, okay, because they look like a bee because they can hover like a hummingbird really fast and staccato. Anyway, I did a test. I had the ability to do a test here last couple of weeks. I put out an orange, like a milk jug cap, and a white milk jug cap filled with soda pop. And I was wondering if they're attracted to certain colors because the orange was always empty first.
They definitely have a different visual pattern than we do. Most of the traps that I've seen made commercially are some forms of yellowish color. So I'm sure they are responding, but the bottom line, it's the bait that's got them excited more so than the color. But as they said,
it was the same bait in both bottle caps, and they were both put out at the same time. And I just thought it was kind of fascinating that the orange was always empty first.
Yeah. You'd have to run it a couple more times because what we know about them, interesting enough, is like honeybees, they communicate. So if the first critters went to the orange one, they would go back and tell the other members that the orange one, and it's not near sophisticated, but there is this, we call it habituation, really, because they get focused in on a food source, and you can give them something they like better closer to the nest, and they don't touch it because they're focused on whatever that original food source was.
So as I said, I guess I never thought about that because I washed them a little bit and you could see there'd be like four or five of them on the cap and then all of a sudden one would fly off and then he'd go and then a couple more would be kind of jumping on each other. Another one would fly off and then some more would come back. So, okay, they were sending messages back to the nest. Huh?
Yeah, just like when somebody recommends a restaurant to you, you've got to go and try that.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We had a Facebook page. May sent us a photo. This is not so little guy on my mail route. And I hope if you're online or near them, I hope you go to my Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show and see this photo. It's quite a.
So it's a giant sawfly. What's got me a little bit puzzled is the color because the one I most often see is black with a little bit of yellow. This is a different species, but because of the antennae and whatnot, it looks like it's a true fly, but there are really two pairs of wings there. So as I said, Cymix is the genus I know. I'm not sure. I'd probably have to look this one up, but there may be some activity up north that of a species that I'm not quite as familiar with.
Okay. So here we got a cicada for...
Yeah, dog day cicada. There are other species in other parts of the country in that genus. I guess what I find this year is they've been active quite late. I mean, I'm still having people sending me pictures this week of nymphs coming out of the ground and adults emerging from those. So,
and here's a pretty one from Angela. Says, this beautiful creature's been hanging around my garden in Eau Claire.
So it is a hawk moth,
yeah,
or a sphinx moth. This is, the snowberry clearwing. Himeris is the genus. We have two species, and without a pretty good look at the very tail end, I always confuse the two. But it's definitely in that group, in whether it's Thisbe or the other species. But bee mimics, both the species you find on honeysuckle, and neat critters,
They're really cool looking, that's for sure. Katie and Delavan, hi there.
Good morning.
Morning.
I've been waiting for Phil to be on.
Good.
I raise milkweeds for monarchs, which, of course, have been exceedingly scarce this year. And the milkweed aphids, which I understand were from the oleander and introduced, have attacked them. My swamp milkweed, four huge clumps were nearly dead from them before I realized how serious it was. And I'm concerned about using anything on there that could potentially harm the monarch caterpillars. I used dish soap, and then I also took dormant oil, just a little bit, and sprayed that on and kills them. But then, of course, they're back within 2 days.
Yeah, well, the oil I'd be a little careful of, because that's pretty tough on the plants if it's a true dormant oil. There are some lighter weight oils, they call them horticultural oils, that you could use that would be a contact kill.
Okay.
Usually as we get later in the season, I mean, this was a classic year, cool springs, aphids are happy as heck. Once the weather warms up, the good guys show up. And so usually with aphids, if you give it a little bit of time, somebody should come in and pretty much naturally control things. But if the plants are showing
up. Well, they were ladybugs, these were literally on stems 6 feet tall, covered with aphids.
Sure. Yeah, and that's kind of typical. But I usually suggest just to be patient. The monarch thing, we will not, there's no way we can have a good season with the way things transpired this year. And I know people are quite concerned because they came out of the winter with the lowest population we've seen in quite some time.
Right.
So it'll be next spring and into early summer, I think, before we see which direction things are going there. But I think you did what I probably would do in my own garden is as long as the plants aren't showing me stress, not do anything. But if it was, I mean, you could even, if you can get the hose out there, have at them with a good forceful stream of water and see if you could dislodge.
Oh, I did that. And I had to literally rub all of them off, thousands of leaves. And the plants were bent over. These 6 foot plants were bent over, severely stressed. They were stunted and there were no flowers and, so then I went out there and really blasted them with soapy water, but it's horrible. And if it's worse next year, I don't know what I'm going to do.
Yeah. No, you don't normally expect that. I mean, I would expect them back, but as far as them just flourishing for as long as they have, that's not very typical. It really isn't. Because I mean, all aphids go through multiple generations, but it seems that all aphids come under natural control given some time.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
All right, thank you.
Yeah, bye-bye. Doug in Westby, hello.
Yeah.
Hi, what can we do for you?
Hello.
Hi there, Doug. What can we do for you? Is he having trouble? Doug, are you listening? I wonder if we lost him. Let's try Randy in Park Falls. Randy, hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. My question is black flies, these little gnats. They're just tearing my horses and mules' ears up terrible. There's clouds of them. Any helpful hints at all on what to put on there? I've been trying everything. Seems like they sweat out after a while, and any kind of home remedies or anything else, it just doesn't stay with them and work.
Yeah, no, there really is no easy answers with this. I mean, some of the insecticides are formulated to hold up a little bit better, but if the animals are quite active, and this has been probably the worst overall black fly year I have seen. And black flies are really a whole family of blood-feeding gnats. Most of them are bird feeders. I know I've talked to Stan Temple a little bit. My suspicion is that we were going to have some pretty tough times with bird recruitment and rearing of young, because I know of bluebirds getting hammered. I know of other ones. And, you know, they breed in moving water. They blow in. And so, you know, sometimes if you can set up in a, they don't like to come in structures, and that's why usually giving an animal a barn or something to come in helps. The other thing is that sometimes, you know, if you can set up a fan or something, because they're not very good flyers. But other than that, there is just no magic remedy. And I'll be honest that a lot of the home remedies you hear about really don't hold up to scientific
testing.
You know, the bounce fabric softener, I think, has come out as the cure of almost anything in the world. And from the entomological standpoint, it really doesn't work.
Doesn't kill anything. So, cure anything.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Diana in Blair, hello.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I'm hoping Dr. Felitari could crouch my curiosity. I have a caterpillar that I have never seen before. It's approximately an inch long. It's not a smooth skin. It looks more like tufts of hair. It's black with orange stripe down the center, and every once in a while, little fluffs of white. And it's on my milkweed, which I know it's not a monarch.
Boy, that helps. That look up milkweed tussock moth.
Tussock
moth. Yeah, tussock moths often are bristly. They're different species, but there is one on milkweed, and I just really suspect. As I said, I was a little stumped till you got to the milkweed, but that would be the first place I would go. Spelled T-U-S-S-O-C-K.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. You know, we talk about biting insects a lot. You mentioned birds here a little bit ago and reminded me of bird mites that seem to be biting people these days.
But this has been a fascinating one. So, you know, when I start to compile the list of who had good years and who had bad years, the thing that will be at the top of the list, I think, are bird mites. They are mites associated with birds, typically cause quite a bit of irritation, but they will bite people given the opportunity. The one problem, if you ever think you have bird mites and you do a search, you'll go to birdmite.org, which is an incredible site of very bad information. They talk about how they live in your house for years and all these horrendous stories that are not true. It is true that bird mites can cause irritation. And so the big trick is finding the nest. And once you clean that up, things are improved dramatically very quickly. But, you know, seeing... Even last week, I must have had 6 or 7 samples come in the lab, and that's quite... I'm used to that in June. I'm not used to that this late, so I don't understand that dynamic of why the bird mites are flourishing. The good news about it, though, in this climate, is we're about 2 or 3 weeks away from it absolutely shutting down. I mean, there's no way they can survive when the young birds have left. There's nothing to eat, and so it's not an ongoing problem, but it's a little frustrating for people. I will tell you, though, they're big enough to see. They look like walking pepper grains against a nice white background. They show up. So invisible bites, we worry about other things other than insects causing the irritation. But if you've got a bird nest outside your bed window and you're starting to pick up mysterious bites, that would be the first place I'd go.
Jerry in Whitewater, thanks for calling. Hi.
Yes. I was wondering a couple of things about the Japanese beetle. There weren't as many as usual this year, which was good. But then also under one of the flowering crab trees that I have where they were just infested last year, there were on the ground look like upside down wasp nests. Is that where they came out of?
No, typically when they come out, all you get is a little pencil like hole sticking out, and shouldn't expect more than that. You know, the drought was very tough on them because most of the lawns were just way too dry for them to breed in. That was part of the fact. The other thing. Is we know in areas that they're established that over time their populations go down. And Dr. Phil Brock here on campus, who happens to be a soil scientist, has been nice enough to share data from his Japanese beetle trapping of the last 7 or 8 years. And he had sent me an email about 3 or 4 weeks ago telling me that the population was 1/30th of what it was in its heyday here in Madison. And
wow.
It's very much what we have observed that... You know, it takes about 10 to 12 years to get these cycles, and you see a little bit of variation depending on the lushness of the previous year. But the good news about Japanese beetles is it will, over time, go down. Now, for golf courses, forget it. They always have ideal conditions. They have a different problem. But for those of us who have problems in our backyard, as I said, one of the delightful things is that in my yard, and even though I live a couple blocks from a golf course, things are just incredibly improved. And I don't remember seeing them this light except when they first got started back in about 98 or 97. So
there we go.
Yeah, I only saw them for about a week. And what could that cluster have been? It's about 2 inches in diameter, inch and a half in diameter. Look, there were about three or four right on the ground underneath that tree.
You know, my guess is that they were probably cicadas that had emerged. Yeah. Because, you know, when we had the 17-year cicadas, they talk about volcanoes, but you get them all over the place because it's the sheer numbers. And here you'd see a little bit of a push-up like that. So I that would be my first guess, especially from the size of the diameter, because, you know, cicadas are pretty big and round. So
this was – the whole cluster was about 2 inches in diameter, and I imagine there were 20 or 30 holes coming out of it.
Hmm. Yeah.
Boy, if you could take a picture and send it to me, I'd be happy to try to see if I could figure something out.
I'll see if it's still there.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, check it out. Thank you very much, Jerry, for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Cyrus-Poisson, our producer. And thanks, Judith, by the way, for filling in for me yesterday while I was scratching my voice at home, feeling sorry for myself. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. Thank you for listening in. Questions, give us a call at 800-642-1234. Post on my Facebook page if you've got a photo. We'd love to see that, too, at the Larry Mueller Show. That's the place to go for my Facebook page. And Doug in Westby has been waiting a while, so let's go to Doug. Hi, Doug.
Yeah, hi there.
What can we do for you?
I'd like to ask about the spotted wing Drosophila fruit fly. I grow raspberries and sell on a retail market, and I've got an infestation in my patch. I understand they were in the Vernon County area last year, and I'm just wondering what we can do to control them, and with either biological controls or chemical controls.
Okay. Unfortunately, it's an exotic insect. We do not have biological controls right now. We would tell you that sanitation of getting the bad berries out will help, but ultimately, the unfortunate part of the story is that it takes large maintenance and a lot of spraying, because the trick of this insect is, unlike normal fruit flies, they lay their eggs just as the berries start to color, and by the time you harvest them, the maggots are already there, and you can't allow that to happen. And
So
if you go to spotted winged Drosophila in Wisconsin, my colleague Christelle Goudeau has a website on this, and she has different fruits and the recommendations for raspberries and strawberries, among other things. And it basically, depending on the product you choose, and there are some organic solutions, but you're limited to how many sprays you can put, how long between the sprays, how long before you harvest it. But it basically is getting into relatively intense spraying in this late season. And, you know, I was hoping that the story last year was we had a blow-in and we would not see it repeat. But the way things have transpired statewide this year, the timing and everything else, we know they have survived the winter. And unfortunately, that suggests to us that this will be now a constant battle every year, that we'll have to start spraying quite early when the berries are starting to come on, and then basically spray all the way up until harvest, because they're out there all, and they just keep building their populations as we get into the later summer.
Would it be good to clean up the patch after the harvest? I don't have a large infestation. I put up vinegar traps, so I know I have them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And,
a couple things. I know Christelle is going to recommend, just from her trials, that there are the apple, the yeast traps work better than the vinegar traps. And that's what the suggestion for growers are, is when the first ones come on. But it seemed like you turned a light on statewide, and it was probably about the 20th, between the 15th and 20th of July this year, that we started to see the first larvae. That was the first generation. It was relatively light. And then, you know, with fruit flies typical going through a generation in 2 to 3 weeks, you know, we're into the second and third generation, and that's when it just seems to explode for people, unfortunately. And as I said, it's definitely widespread enough that I don't believe there's a county in the state that doesn't have activity, as far as I'm concerned.
Okay.
All right, Doug, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jerry sent us a Facebook question wondering if you could recommend an Android app for insect identification.
To be honest, with me and my little flip phone, I don't have those kind of apps. And so it'd be worth looking at. The dilemma is always numbers. You know, we have 25,000 species of insects in this state, and so... You know, I know that there are some good butterfly apps in the like, but when you start getting more widespread, it gets tough. And as I said, so I do apologize. It's just not something I've been keeping up on.
Bob also sent a Facebook question. He's from the Madison. He said, deer ticks, are they in my backyard in Madison's West Side? How would I be able to tell?
If you're the average West Side home in Hill Farms or whatnot, no. If you are on the West Side up against kind of wild areas, you know, including the Arboretum, you know, then possibly. But they don't do well in lawns. That's just too hostile an environment, so you need definitely more lawn grass, more diverse habitat, you know, and, you know, it's interesting. I have not had the time to, or found my colleague, Susan Paskowitz. There was a piece that CDC had out last week making the comment that they believe that there's tenfold the number of Lyme cases than are being reported. And I just didn't see enough of the piece to be able to sort through what they were really saying. To have 30,000 cases of Lyme disease seems high to me in this state.
Yeah.
You know, we are averaging about 3,000. I'm sure they're underreported. And as I said, without a chance to talk to Susan, I'm not sure. I think that needs some clarification because it seems. But the bottom line is we have seen a resurgence in ticks. And, you know, Susan had the piece out on Amblyomma, the Lone Star tick being established in the state now. And so you got to keep your guard up. And with deer ticks, you got to keep your guard up until there's snow on the ground. And
And Bob was wondering as well, what percentage of deer ticks actually carry the Lyme disease? Do we have any idea?
So the average, and it can vary by where you sample, but the average that Susan and her students are picking up is about 40% in the adults. So that's 4 out of 10. The nymphs, because they've only fed once on mice, have half the chance of acquiring it. So you figure it's 20%. And historically, it was 18% in the adults if we go back, you know, 10, 12 years ago. And so there's definitely been a jump. What's significant about that is one of the recommendations from CDC is if you are in a state where you're going over 20% in the adults and you have a deer tick on you, you know it's a deer tick, and you know it was there that 36 hours or more to transmit, that they will give you a 1 day's dose of antibiotic as a treatment. Mm. And so we're over that threshold. And so I think that's something to keep in your pocket if you have a deer tick on, is to chat with your physician. And it wouldn't hurt if they're not aware of that. I would think so, that that's what the guidelines are. And as I said, there's no question we're well above the 20% in the adults.
John in Barron County has a question for you. Hi, John.
Hi. I have a photo of a spider here. A friend asked me to help him identify it, but I need more expertise than what I have.
Okay.
Well, you can ship it down. I'll tell you a couple things about spiders. If you're really into spiders, you have to have a good picture of the face and the eyes to tell them apart. Now, sometimes things are distinctive enough, but just color patterns and whatnot, honestly, is there's just too many different kinds of spiders. But you can ship it to me. You can ship it down to Larry, either way, and I'll give a hack at it. I'll tell you that the spiders I see quite commonly right now, the orb weaver spiders, and some are called marble spiders and barn spiders. There's quite a diversity. Usually the females have a relatively large round abdomen that can be bright orange, bright yellow, blacks, all kinds of neat markings on it, almost like somebody painted it. And another thing that's quite distinctive about many of the species is they have banded legs, usually a contrast of yellow and black, orange and black, or white and black legs. They do make the... Okay. And so typical late summer, great photographic subjects, I think, for people. Harmless to people. But they're kind of big enough and scary enough looking as people get quite concerned about. Not an indoor spider at all. They might make a web in your bushes, but more typically out in long grasses and those kind of places.
Yeah, that's what it's... What's the name again?
Well, the family is called orb weaver spider. And a real common one is Argiope, the big black and yellow garden spider, but there are numerous other ones. And interesting enough, if you ever get into a website that has a lot of pictures, they're so diverse even within a species. You can have some that are yellow, some that are orange, and some that are tan, and it's all the same species. And so that's why, other than knowing the family of spiders, we're often quite limited in what we can do with identification.
Mm-hmm. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have... another Facebook photo of an insect here, Phil. It's got something kind of an interesting structure.
I think it's a potter wasp. and that is the nesting structure of a potter wasp. And as the name implies, they construct this little mud and tube, and then there's like a top of a vase vessel in there. And grubs in there developing on whatever mom provides. You know, some are spider catchers, some catch other kinds of creatures. Neat structure. And again, it reminded like a little clay pot. That would be the best way of describing it.
Yeah, it's really cool. Mike in Algoma, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, I've got an observation and a question. Cut down a ash tree, a live, healthy ash tree in the winter. Split it, stacked it, and one of the first warm days, I went out and looked at the pile, and it was covered with frisk from the burrows of the powder post beetle, I assume, on a one-inch grid. It was just amazing.
Yeah, well, I would think more likely that was the eastern ash bark beetle. And the only reason I say that, the holes would be the same size, but your wood was too green, too high a moisture, so it would be perfect for the eastern ash bark beetles. Powder post beetles typically get after wood 2 to 3 years after cutting when it's more seasoned.
Okay. All right, well, now I look at the pile, and it's covered with very, very tiny black flies. Any idea what those are?
They may be parasites, not flies indeed, but little tiny wasps that are parasites of the grubs of the eastern ash bark beetle. That would be my first guess.
So they're eating up they're getting rid of your problem.
Now, the other side of it is it could be aphids falling down if you've got a tree above it, and they're kind of raining down and just kind of hang. But as I said, my first take is it may be one of these very small, you know, many of those parasitic wasps are only a millimeter or 2 millimeters in size. And they're always very host specific. They're not a stinging wasp as far as people are concerned. But given the story you've told me, that would be my first guess.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you very much for the information.
Yeah. Thanks, Mike, for calling. David Eau Claire. Hello.
Hi there. I'm calling my son. He's just bought a house, and he went down in his basement the other day to flip some fuses. And he hadn't been down there for a couple days, and now all of a sudden he said his floor, basement floor, is covered with these things that look like fleas. They jump, and then they crawl onto his legs, and then they crawl.
Yeah, they're called springtails. Springtails live in the ground, but they will live in damp areas. And so the thing that has got to be sorted out here is, are they just accumulating in the basement because it's damp and a nice place to hang out? Or are they falling in from outside? And so the first thing is anything you do to dry the basement would be very important. I would look outside. If it looks like there's more springtails outside than inside, then we start having to look at all the vents, door sweeps, any kind of opening that things can sneak through and fall in the basement. Anything you can do to get that sealed up will solve the problem. It's, you know, they typically can't breed in the basement because there's not the organic matter. And a lot of times, it's, you know, when the furnace comes on, you know the house is going to dry. But as I said, I just vacuum what's inside. I don't think there's any reason to spray them inside. If the source was outside, sometimes we do spray along the outside foundation to help us kind of knock them down before they migrate in. But as I said, I like the idea of also trying to figure out where they sneak in. And a lot of times it's coming up underneath the siding. And so getting that tightened up will help.
Mm-hmm. Good luck, Dave. Thanks. Harold in Shawano County. Hello.
Hello. I have a linden tree and a river birch. The birch is it's kind of small, 10 feet high. But I have a nest in each tree. It looks like a cocoon. The one in the linden tree is really huge. And it looks, I don't know what's in it because they can't get up there to cut it down.
I mean, by huge, you're taking 2 feet?
I would say at least 2 feet.
Okay, that's probably fall webworm. And this late in the game, they're probably done eating, but that kind of loose webbing nest is left behind. Right. It's just a little white fuzzy caterpillar, and as I said, I would not be concerned there.
Okay.
Okay. Yep.
Thank you, Harold. Anne in Milwaukee, hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I have a question about my pet spider, Charlotte. I found her wandering in my house in probably about mid-April, and she was just so beautiful, and I kind of like spiders, so I scooped her up, named her Charlotte, got an aquarium, have been feeding her crickets, and she's doing marvelously. Now, since I found her, I don't know if this is kind of a virgin birth or what, but she's had babies 2 times. Now, I know she hasn't been out dating since I found her. So, you know, what is it with spiders?
Well, insects pull the same game. It's quite common for females to store sperm after mating for extended periods of time. They have a special little sperm perched or purse that they keep it alive. And so that means she was an adult when you found her. And again, she had relations. And now, typically what will happen over time is that, and it depends on the species. It's not unusual for insects and spiders only to mate once, but there are exceptions to that rule. But as the sperm numbers start to go down, then she will basically lay non-viable eggs. You know, many of our spiders only live for a year or two, so you know, it's not as if that would go for a long time. And so they said, I just suspect that she had mated, and until she matured her eggs and it was time to fertilize them, she just maintained the sperm within her body, which is, as I said, a very common arthropod trick.
Okay, she's a bold jumper. And I had really never seen one before, but she's just so beautiful. You know, it just seemed weird that the first time I find one in my house, you know, she's already mated.
Well, jumping spiders do live quite a bit longer, you know, so that may come into play, too. So.
Okay, because I'm kind of fond of her. And, you know, clearly there was no other name I could give her other than Charlotte.
No, of course not.
You know, given that I had read the story to my children and then my grandchildren, and it turned out to be the correct name for her. You know, and the babies, she's a very prolific mom.
Yeah, well, most arthropods are. I mean, that's the interesting thing, the dynamic of reproductive potential. Of course, most of the time they don't succeed at having it, but you just can imagine all those little mouths to feed. That's
a lot of work there for in front of mom. Ann, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. We have a Facebook photo here that's pretty cool. Mary Roth wonders, what's this insect?
Okay, it's a pelicynid wasp. And pelicynid wasps are grub parasites. And
really
so they use this very long abdomen to put the eggs into the ground. And then their larvae go after various kinds of white grubs and the like. And so neat creature, and males are extremely rare for that particular species.
And here's another one, another insect from Josh.
Okay, so we know it's a moth. My first guess, it's a type of noctuid moth, but that's still a very large family. I don't recognize the wing patterns off the top. Would have to get out one of my magic books to kind of work it through. But it's in the cutworm family. It doesn't appear quite to be one of the underwings, which is a very common group right now. Another small chance that it's a pyralid moth, because some of them are very, we call ornate, but very colorful wings. But as I said, just the way it's sitting there in the wing patterns, I think it's a species of noctuid, and it's just a question of which one.
Oh, very, very cool. Dave and Fond du Lac, thanks for calling. Hi.
Hi, thanks. What preventative measures can I take to keep the emerald ash borer away from my 25-year-old seemingly healthy ash trees?
So you can do things yourself, or you can get a professional arborist to come in. Basically, the treatment strategies are either injecting products into the trunk, which has to be done by the arborist, or there are products that you can buy at the local garden store that are systemic, that are most of them will have you measure the outside circumference of the tree to figure out how much product you need. You mix it up in a bucket, and you pour it next to the trunk and let the roots take it up and move it through. And so, you know, the rates will differ depending, of course, the diameter of the tree. For very big trees, to be honest, just because of label restrictions, sometimes it's best to give a fall treatment and then reapply the next spring, which is legal. It is not legal to put a fall treatment and a spring treatment on the same calendar year. Bigger trees get a little trickier to work with. Some good information, if you go to Emerald Ash Borer, my colleague Chris Williamson and his people have put up some good, you know, how-to little YouTube videos. Now's the time to put up the fight, especially with the activity taking off in your county now. And that's our recommendations, is if there's activity within 15 miles of your home, then it's very worthy to put on the treatments. You know, Sauk County went positive this year, Fond du Lac went county, Winnebago went county, and now up in Superior. And so we definitely have continued to see it move. Next couple of weeks, if we don't get any more reports, that's somewhat, encouraging. But the last 2 years in particular, as I said, it's really made some major inroads into the state. And so if people have got very valuable trees like you've got, now's the time, as I said, if it's in your county, to start considering. Some of the treatments that the professional people put on can last for 3 years. It just depends. Some of this is convenience and the like, but it's definitely one way or the other, whether you treat or have somebody treat it for you, now would be the time to consider that.
And what type of establishment do you buy the product at?
Usually, a bigger garden center. I'd be honest, I think some of the box stores, the Home Depots and okay. whatnot. Bayer has a product line, but the product they have is went generic, so there's multiple other packaging. Probably not the average hardware store, just because, they're concentrating more on how to kill wasps and ants and maybe something in your vegetables. So, as I said, but any kind of garden store, and anybody that has a bigger home and garden section in their store would definitely have one of these products.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Dave. Thanks a lot for calling. Back to Facebook for a second here. Nathan sent a photo of an insect with a very long antenna.
So that is a male. In the family is longhorn wood borer, but that particular one is from a genus, Monochamus, we call pine sawyers, common in dead and dying pine trees. Very impressive and looks almost a dead ringer for the Asian longhorn beetle. The only difference, the Asian longhorn beetle would be size and color the same, but has very distinct white polka dots on the back. And by polka dots, I mean round polka dots. There's no question. And so the pine sawyers, after the dead trees, unfortunately, Asian longhorn beetle goes after live maple trees, but we have not found that in the state.
And here is finally one more.
Okay, so this is a carrion beetle. The family is Sylphidae, cool. There are a number of species. They're usually pretty reasonable sized. And as the name implies, you find them on dead animals, but the adults are attracted to lights. So sometimes they just kind of show. If somebody found three or four showing up in their bedroom, then I start thinking about a squirrel had passed in the attic or something similar to that. So neat creature. As I said, a number of species. I can't quite see enough detail to give you the species name, but if you
so this is the three pictures. It's, what was it again?
Carrion beetle.
Carrion beetle.
Yeah,
okay.
Or Sylphidae is the family name that we use.
Okay, very good. We have John in Sun Prairie with a question for you, Phil. Hi, John.
Hi. I had a question. Occasionally, I'll wake up and I'll find that I've been bit on the leg or something during the night, and I'm assuming a spider or something. But one day, I actually had about three bites right in a row, and I just happened to go on the internet and look it up, and I came up with this breakfast, lunch, dinner thing from bed bugs. And of course, the more I researched it, the more worried I got, because it sounds like they're very bad. But is there any way you can tell for sure, or is there anything that mimics a bed bug bite pattern?
Yeah. No, you can't tell anything for sure, and yes, there's a lot of things that mimic, including fleas. Cat fleas typically will feed in that pattern because they don't like the way you feed. And so I always warn people is you cannot diagnose bites purely by how they appear. Now, the situation and the like, but it is very difficult. What we tend to find is most of the time what people think are spider bites are not. It's not easy to get spiders to bite. If they do, the only way you can really verify it is to take a hand lens and verify that there's a double puncture mark, because all spiders have two fangs, and when they bite, they leave two little holes behind. But we find assassin bugs and you can't rule out sometimes that it wasn't a mosquito that happened to be in the bedroom that decided to, find some skin to feed on. And so it really does get tough. But what we tend to try to sort through is if it's reoccurring, and then we got to find out who indeed is the culprit here. And so whether you put little glue boards or other things out, keep your eyes open. But the other thing I always warn people about, because some bite reactions are delayed by a number of hours, is sometimes you have to think through it. Could be even where you were earlier in the day, where you're outside picnicking and you had some exposure there to something. We were talking earlier about the bird mites. Now, typically when I get bird mite bites, I get bites all over a person, no patterns per se. And it isn't unusual to have a little bit of a blistering in the center of the bite. That just seems to be a somewhat normal reaction. But the problem is we all react somewhat differently. So you can't purely tell on that. So If it reoccurs, the chance of bed bug, there's a bed bug associated with bats that will not breed on people. There's a bed bug associated with chimney swifts. There's a bed bug associated with barn swallows. And then the human bed bug, unless you were to bring it into your environment because of traveling and bringing it in, or used furniture, or somebody visiting that brought it in their suitcase, you do not expect human bed bugs to show up in your home unless, again, they are transported by somebody.
Wow. There we go. Thank you. Thanks a lot for calling, John. Appreciate it. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Having some fun today talking about insects with Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist. Thank you for listening in, by the way. If you have a question, I hope you'll call at 800-642-1234. Or maybe you've got a photo, you want an ID of an insect you have. Go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo or a question and a question there if you'd like. And Phil, Kyle Gigot sent us another spider picture from Florence County. It's about 2 inches across from leg tip to leg tip.
So I can somewhat pick up on the banding of the legs. So again, as I mentioned, is to really be sure what the spider is, you got to see their eye placements and whatnot. But this looks like what we would call the fishing spider. The genus is Dolomites. And although, as the name implies, you find them next to water a lot, they can be quite a distance away. So it's a big, scary-looking spider, similar to a wolf spider, and really not that distantly related. But that's who I think this is the family is called the fishing spiders, and the genus is Dolomites. And we've got a couple species you could find in the state.
And Robert emailed and said, I saw a daddy long legs with little red balls all over its legs and body. Tried to get a picture, but it wouldn't stand still long enough. What was that? Were they eggs or
no? Those are mites,
oh.
And they're hitchhiking. We call them phoretic mites, and they are hitchhiking on. And in some cases they are parasitic. In some cases they're not. Without seeing what the mites are, but it isn't that unusual. It's quite common under the wings of some of the beetles too. You see large numbers of mites. And that little carrion beetle that we had seen before,
yeah,
classic. There's a dark brown mite you'll see associated with those. And the mites use the carrion beetle to get from carcass to carcass because they are predaceous on fly eggs.
So they're not going to kill that.
No.
No, they want that beetle to get them to the next.
That's their airplane.
Right. Well, Vic in Manitowoc. Hello.
Good morning.
Morning.
I have a question about two wild bee nests that are creating problems. One is quite near a horse's stall, and the other is right next to a water tap. And my friend has already been to the doctor with a response to one of them. She tried a bug bomb last night but could not seem to impact. The ones in the ground seem to be living under a concrete slab, which can be moved.
Yeah, no,
and the ones in the barn are behind some wall.
Okay, so the trick with anything you cannot physically see the nest, to me, is to use a dust, not a spray or a bomb. It's been my experience. You don't get good results. And so you need to use a dust, some kind of garden dust. And, you know, permethrin and deltamethrin and 7, there's all kinds of garden dust, but it has to be a dust, not a spray. So you dust the entrance. You do this usually about 7:30, 8 o'clock at night. But if you don't know where the entrance is, you got a problem. Because what the dust does is it coats the entrance. They come and go, does them in. I'm guessing they're ground nesting yellow jackets or bumblebees, either or.
They said they're not the conventional yellow jacket, the little plump, pertly. They are yellow and black, skinny, I guess, she does know where the two entries are.
Okay, well, that would work. Now, there is more than one species of ground nesting yellow jacket. Bees tend to be quite fuzzy. Yellow jackets tend to be either black or yellow or black and white. But if you look at them close enough, they might be brightly colored, but they're not covered with a fine fuzzy fur. Now, in the case of both yellow jackets and bumblebees, though, is usually by about the middle of October, the colonies die out on their own. And so what we usually try to assess is if it's a place with a lot of people traffic, they need to be dealt with because the biggest threat is if the nest is disturbed. Where if it's an area where nobody goes, no pets go, as I said, it's better to just kind of let it run its course, I think, in most cases.
Well, this pet lives next to it, the young horse, and she has to turn her water tap on,
yeah,
which is how she got attacked in the first place.
Yeah. Now, the other thing that it gets a little tricky sometimes, like when they get up under siding and other places, is that how do you get the dust to them? And sometimes you have to use an old turkey baster or use some kind of other device to allow you to blow the dust in. They do sell in some hardware stores something called a bulb duster. And so, as they said, there are devices made purposely for allowing you to blow the dust through a little straw-like tube so that you can get it to where you need to.
Good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We have Maggie and Wausau on board next. Hi, Maggie.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question has to do with identifying carpenter ants, and then if what is an effective way to eradicate the problem? Is there a commercial product available?
Well, the bottom line, and this is one of those ones, it sounds like I'm smart, but if you can find the nest and kill the queen, any ant spray will do it. And so if it's obvious that there's sawdust coming out from a windowsill, you spray into it, that should do it. There are baits available. If you don't know where the nest is, to be honest, the baits work better in the spring than they do in the fall, and you have to commercially mail order them or go on the internet because I can't send you to the store. They just don't market them to homeowners. There's also some other products that professionally can be put on around the outside of a house that will kill carpenter ants if that's a problem. A product called Termidor is something that the pest control services use quite a bit with a lot of effect. So any of the above, but the problem if you're trying to do it yourself is you've got to have an educated guess where they are, because you got to kill the queen, and she is in the nest. She will not be coming out. Said sometimes it's obvious, sometimes it's very frustrating finding where the nest is.
Mm-hmm.
If the nest is identifiable at the location in the house, is it best to have an approach from the outside then with a professional exterminator?
No. It basically is however you can get product to them. If it's in a wall, sometimes either if you've got to look for an existing seam or you might have to drill a small hole. It's just about where it physically is the best to get the product to where they are. And sometimes that's coming from the outside. Sometimes that's coming from underneath. It just depends. Mm-hmm. I think it's well worth trying to do yourself. If that doesn't work, then you can take the next step. I mean, what we're balancing here is, you can solve it for $5 if you've got the right stuff in the right place. If you get a pest control service, it will be more expensive. But as I said, I kind of use them as a later resort, maybe not right. The last resort all the time. You said they've got some products, but if, treatments can run you a couple $100 or more, and so you're kind of balancing what makes more sense there.
Yeah, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And we have more callers online for sure. I'm wondering, Phil, I just had a question. It almost slipped my mind for a minute there. There's still some cold effects going on here a little bit, but I wonder, you've often said that if you kill the queen, that the rest of the everybody else dies, or is it the once the queen dies, does then everybody just quit working?
And no, you'll see some stragglers in activity, but what you've got is a colony of sterile females. And so typically, the way, just like bees do, you constantly have new bees brought into the, or new ants brought into the environment.
Okay.
So the queen's done, you've shut off the reproduction. And they honestly get confused. There's some hormonal control going on here, and when the queen's taken out, the hormones aren't there. And so you will see, but they're all sterile females. They can't start nests, so it's not a problem.
So it's pretty quickly that they'll be dead.
And typically, because a lot of those workers are in the nest protecting the queen, raising the young, as I said, you're killing lots of ants off when you get to that right spot versus, when you smush an ant that's going through your kitchen, that's just a worker, and she's very replaceable, and that's why that strategy doesn't work.
Okay. Gotcha. Tim and Eau Claire, hi.
Hi. I've been noticing some either blue or purple and a couple I guess the best way to put it is they almost look metallic bees. I guess maybe they're hornets. I don't really know the difference between them, of course, because I'm, everybody calls them different things, that have been around my house, a couple of them in my house. I did a little bit of research, and I found that they might be some that kill grasshoppers, which would make sense because we have a drastic number of grasshoppers in our area this year. I'm wondering if they also like to go after humans at all, if they're, if they specifically sting humans or if they leave us alone.
So there's a whole bunch of what we call thread-waisted wasps or sphecid wasps, and first of all, they're what we call solitary, in that each individual digs its own burrow or finds its own tube and goes out and collects whatever its prey is. Spiders, grasshoppers, crickets. I said there's a number of different species. The general rule with solitary wasps and bees is they're very non-aggressive. There's no true nest to defend. That's when you usually get in the biggest trouble. They still are capable of stinging. I mean, if one flies up your shirt and it feels threatened, it will sting you. So it's not, but it's really very difficult to get them to sting. And indoors, you got to be careful, whether you want to try to figure a way of escorting them out or, dispatch them, that's fine. But you don't worry about a nest where there's hundreds more, because that's just not the way they function. And a lot of times when you see them, they do also collect pollen. So there's some pollination aspects to it. But many of them use a protein source of various insects as their prey. And so what you're doing is when you're watching them flying around out there or running around the ground, they're looking for something. They're hunting is a way of thinking of it. And, pretty common late summer. Said usually by you get into the middle of September or so, their populations come under major decline.
There we go. Thanks a lot, Tim, for calling. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension entomologist, our guest. He's going to be with us right up until 12:30 today. You'll be able to join in at this number, 1-800-642-1234, or post on my Facebook page a photo and question at the Larry Mueller Show. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. No matter what the season, there are countless insects around us. And as temperatures start to drop overall and the days get shorter, we may see a lot more of them indoors than we perhaps would like to. Larry Mueller here. I'm with entomologist Phil Pelletieri. He's our guide to the world of insects. He helps us figure out what we're dealing with and what to do. And Phil, as always, great to have you with us. Appreciate it very much.
Nice to be here, Larry.
We have a number of callers online who have questions for you, and Sue in Bennett, Wisconsin's right here, so let's go to Sue. Hi, Sue. Thank you for waiting.
Hi, Larry and Phil. Thank you for taking my call. I have two questions. One is about ants, and the other is about clothes moths. We have about 20 acres of property, and we have several very large ant nests or hills ranging in, I'd say, maybe 8 to 10 inches high, 8 to 10 inches across on where the woods are, and then I've noticed very smaller ones that are spreading out, and I'm wondering, do I need to be concerned about this? One of the things I've noticed is that we have several what I refer to as very tiny sinkholes. They're about maybe 4 to 8 inches across, and then a little bit, about 4 to 6 to 8 inches in depth, and I'm wondering if there's any correlation between the ants and those holes that I'm seeing. And then on the clothes moths, I'm wondering how to control for those. I've taken everything that was wool and put it in plastic bins with mothballs, but I've noticed that I've got lots of moths in the traps that I set out, and I'm wondering what else do they eat and how do I control for those.
Okay. So the ants, you have at least one, wouldn't surprise me, multiple species of what we call field ants. The genus is Formica. Some of them will make mounds 2 feet high and 4 feet wide. It just depends on the species. They're predators by nature. The only problem we have with them is if they're next to a child's sandbox, they bite. And you can't garden with them very well because they, in some cases, will literally kill plants around them that will want to shade their nest. Not all the species do that, but we have to kind of watch with it. So most of the time we let them be. They're really important to recycle nutrients and important in many kind of environments. If they're in a place you don't want them, we've talked about before in the show, is that you've got to kill the queen. She's down on the ground. The best way to do that is to make two or three channels with a long rod or tube and then put your treatment down in there so you're soaking deep enough. So you're basically spot treating. And that's why it's also not practical. If you've got multiple nests on a 20-acre piece, said, why bother?
Now the clothes, I'm more than happy to let them be as long as I know they're not doing any damage.
Yeah, no, and of anything, I wouldn't expect a sinkhole. It's the other way. It's quite common when you burn prairies, you see these large mounds that, as I said, just kind of stick up. And in fact, even research went on campus years ago at the Arboretum, found out how important that these species that were out in the prairies were to the ecosystem. Now, the clothes moths, anything that is feather or animal hair is a potential food source. And so they do get into wool, they do get into silk, they will not get into cotton because it doesn't have high enough protein. And you have a pheromone-type closed moth trap?
I think so, yes.
Because, you know, by far the most common moth I see is not associated with wool, but it's a food pest like the Indian meal moth. It's more grain-based. And, you know, closed moths, typically people don't see many adults. What you tend to find is in the case of the webbing closed moth or the case-making closed moth, you see both the damage and either little cigar-like cases or this webbing in very powdery, what we call frass or waste that accumulates. And, you know, it's kind of like having a fire. You got to find the source, you know. And so, you know, there really isn't any magic sprays that's trying to hunt it down. And what they seem to like are things that are in undisturbed places. So it's more likely in a closet than it is out in your living space.
And that's exactly right. They are in the closets.
Well, but as I said, I will tell you, I probably see 19 cases of Indian meal moth, the dry goods or pantry pest, to every true case of closed moth. Now, if you had a bunch of wool rugs that got chewed on, then there's no question it's one of the two species of closed
moth.
No,
but I did have wool clothes last year, and I took all of those, as I said, I got rid of everything that was wool.
That was good. In fact, to be honest, putting things away clean, you don't even need the mothballs in tight-fitting plastic is all you really need to do there.
And that's exactly what I did.
Okay. All so right. If things have been reoccurring, I'm more inclined, as I said, look up Indian meal moth on the internet to see. The moth is bigger. It's somewhat banded. It's kind of two-toned in color. True closed moths are really small. They're kind of golden in color, really don't have much markings unless you get them under a microscope.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. I think that's what I have.
All right. Thank you, Sue. Thanks for calling. Let's turn to Roger in Deer Park, Illinois next. Hi, Roger.
Well, I want to talk about insect emotions here real quickly. I had a little aquarium with some varied insects in it that I was going to take to my photography class because I was teaching a class about macro photography. And by the way, I let all the insects go back to their original environment when we're through with these things. But there were some crickets in there, and a stone centipede was going across the basement floor, so I put the centipede in there. And here's what I'm talking about, the emotions. The centipede was going over by the crickets, and these crickets would back off in a position like they were scared, and they were shaking. They were literally shaking, and it was really something weird to look at. So I took the centipede out and let it go again, and our class was pretty successful. But the way these crickets were shaking, I mean, it had to show some emotion there. And they were scared.
Yeah, I just not a good enough student of cricket biology to know what kind of other explanations would be there. You know, typically you don't expect insects. I mean, you can expect them to react to their environment. It doesn't surprise me that they would react to a predator, but I'm not quite sure what the shaking was about. And as I said, unfortunately, I don't know if I know anybody that works enough with crickets to be able to answer that one for you.
No. Oh, well, that may be. Yeah, you may come. That'll be in the back of your mind now.
So, yes. We'll ponder this one for a little while. See if I can find an orthopteran expert that might have an explanation.
We may have an explanation next time Phil's on, Roger. Stay tuned. Stay tuned. Joanne in Appleton. Hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a quick question. I've noticed during the last 10 days, I have honeybees drinking the water at the bird bath.
Oh, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep.
Yep. That's quite common. And that tells me whether it's a wild colony or somebody has a colony within, I'm guessing, a couple hundred yards of your house. And you know, they're very non-aggressive at that state because there's no nest to defend. They're just out getting honey. They bring it back to the nest and they literally cause it to evaporate. It's their way of air conditioning is what it is. So considering the kind of weather we've been through the last week, I'm sure their water needs are up. And then, of course, if you're getting to some dry areas, there's less water available. So we had a lot of complaints about that last year because of the drought. And as I said, bird baths were one of the few sources of water for both bees and wasps.
Yeah.
Okay. I just I don't mind them. I had never seen it before and wondered why they were doing that. So just thought I'd call in. Thank you.
Yep. Thanks a lot for calling. We have a number of wasps that come to our bird feeder along with the birds. And you know, when there'll be times when there's not a wasp in sight. I'll get the hose out, and I'm watering, and it's kind of a shower water system, and they seem to appear out of almost nowhere. Pretty soon, I've got a whole bunch of wasps, kind of under the shower.
Yeah, that. Well, you know, and the other thing that I was watching, it was quite interesting. The last couple of days, I've been out in the field, and we have this European paper wasp that has been moving through the state. And I'm not sure if my colleague Bob Jean had records for Iowa County, but I can verify that they were there because we were moving some stuff. And we just bumped the side of a tin building, and all of a sudden, out of one little hole came bubbling all these little friends. And late summer is the time for wasps to be active. You just got to be a little careful because some of these, they're kind of hidden. We have a lot of problems when people are mowing lawns. The vibration sets these things off.
I was bitten, I don't know, probably 10 times a few years ago, right? It was the day of the Ironman competition, so in Madison, so it would have been right about now, and it was painful.
The thing about yellow jackets and ground wasps is that they don't leave a stinger behind, but they can still sting you multiple times, and it's quite common to be really, I think, quite a bit more painful than a quote bee sting. And then it's not uncommon, aside from quite a bit of swelling, is to have intense itching for a few days. So it's just not a pleasant experience.
No, it isn't. We had an email from Rana and Fairchild who said we've recently had 1 to 4 insects per day appearing indoors. They're about 3/8 of an inch long body, head and curly antenna. The upper body is a little bigger than the head. A narrow waist and a rounded rear end with a tiny stinger on it. 6 legs, 4 wings, 2 larger than others. Back legs have an elegant curve to the knee where a little flange is. They're hard to kill and sting or bite when you smack one barehanded.
So my first guess is it's an ichneumonid of some sort, which is a group of parasitic wasps. And they use that little stinger, per se, to lay eggs. And I'm interested in her comment about stinging, because they really don't sting, per se. The device is an egg-laying device. And the longer the egg-laying device, the harder it is for them to get at their prey. So we've got some that will go into wood a couple inches deep to go after some of the critters that are there. So that is I'd look up just ichneumonid wasp, realizing that the color patterns can vary a bit. Other than that, so what typically happens, you can get 4 or 5 ichneumonid wasps out of one caterpillar. So I'm wondering if there was some kind of insect prey that they had parasitized and killed, and now we're just seeing the adults coming out. That's at least my first guess.
Gene in Big Bend, hello.
Hi. I have a question about a chunky black fly with gray wings. It's about 1/2 inch long. I had it in the house here. I'm sure there's only one, but it was buzz and fly, but I just couldn't get it until the 5th day that I finally was able to swat it because it moved so quickly. Apparently, as you say, 1/2 inch long. Certainly, we apparently came in when we came through the door sometime, but there doesn't seem to be any others in the house at all.
Yeah, boy, I just... I'm not sure. I'd have to see it. I don't know if it's a robber fly or something else, but they said just with a description, there's not enough for me to go with.
Sorry, we can't help you there, Gene, but I appreciate your call. We go back to Facebook for a minute here because, man, we have so many photos. If you're on Facebook and have a chance to go to it, my Facebook page, just go to the Larry Mueller Show, and you'll see all these wonderful insect photos. What do we got here? This is from listener Dylan. This is an insect he saw in Perot State Park.
Okay, so the critter is called an eyed click beetle. It's one of the bigger click beetles. These can approach 2 inches in length. They have these false eyes up on the
big,
right, and they flip. If you touch one, it's almost like you snap your fingers. They have that device to be able to push out.
And listener Virginia sent a very interesting story along with a photo here that looks like a piece of dried flower or something. She saw this little bug on a picnic table near Lake Superior, thought it was a tiny dried flower, but then it began to move. When I touched it gently, a pile of rubbish fell off it.
Okay, so I'm guessing here, but there is, in the assassin bug group, there are one in particular called the masked hunter bug. In the nymphs, the immature stages literally will glue in your house dust, so they look like dust bunnies, but outdoors they will use vegetation and put it on as camouflage. So that's my first guess, is it's probably an assassin bug that was hiding underneath that, an immature assassin bug. The adults don't do that. So that's my best guess.
Brent in Jackson. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
This is about 2 or 3 years ago. We were sitting out on our deck one evening, and this moss showed up, and it landed on my daughter. And it just kept going back to her. But the moth was the size of a pie plate, about 8 inches, I'd say.
Okay, what was the base color of the moth?
It was a whitish, creamy color.
Did it have long tails?
No, it did not have a long tail.
Hmm.
But it did have, it looked like it had eye dots on its wings.
Okay, so it's one of the wild silkworms. I don't know if it's Polyphemus. They're a light tan color. What I was also fishing for, one of the interesting things since I've been on the show last, is I had 2 pictures of black witch moths sent to me from the Madison area.
Oh.
That's a Mexican species, and literally it's the size of a bat. You can get wingspans of 10 inches plus. They blow up here. They can't breed up here. We don't have the right plants, but it's one of these interesting phenomena. And it's big enough and showy enough, you would not forget it, but they don't have eye spots. So the eye spots, as I said, I would look up Polyphemus moth, not quite sure. Females don't like to fly much, and then the males are the ones that tend to come. They're very short lived. They don't feed as adults. They make great bat food, and that's probably the problem why they don't live so long, is the bats tend to feast on them. But definitely in the wild silkworm group, and it's just a question of which one of the species, and that would be my first guess.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
Thank you very much.
Yep, thanks a lot for calling. Just a reminder to people, too, some people have told me, I'm not on Facebook, so I can't see your photos. Actually, that's not true. You don't need to be a member of Facebook to see our posts, so you just can't post yourself, but you can see posts if you're a member of Facebook. So, Josie in Sheboygan, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a cockatoo, and quite often I find these little tiny moths, and they look like little miniature regular moths that you see that flutter around light and everything. And I wonder why they're drawn to her water dish all the time.
Yeah, there's no moths that I normally, because most moths would not need water. So I don't know if that's an artifact, although then I get into things like moth flies that look like moths that are not. You can get me a picture or something. I think I can give you a little bit better idea who it is and then kind of figure out if it's just a coincidence or there is a water need. But, typically indoors, most of the moths we have are associated with pet food and cereal-based products. They're basically, again, a cupboard pest.
And they wouldn't be attracted to the food either, or, maybe by accident they go into the water?
Well, 2 thoughts there. I mean, it depends a bit on if it's a very high-protein, greasy food. That's not the kind I see this particular group in. It's more grain-based stuff. And sometimes if it's just coming, you wonder if the moths are in the pet food and you weren't picking it up and they're just kind of fluttering off the food. What you typically see, though, those ones associated with pet food often leave a lot of webbing in the box or the bag of pet food and little white worms. So then the source is somewhere else, in as I said, but without knowing, what gets difficult is even when people see small moths in the house is, I've got hundreds of ones to work with. Most of them are outdoor critters, and so if I know that, let's say, there might be a hole in the screen or something else is the source, versus I've got about 4 or 5 species that will, again, given the right opportunity, take advantage of something in the house. And it gets very frustrating for people because you see the adult sitting out in your kitchen and the problem is a cardboard box sitting off in a cupboard somewhere. And so if it was that type, that's the kind of thing you would look for.
Also, I was going to ask you, my bird planted tons of sunflowers in my little yard, and I noticed that they're being eaten quite rapidly now. The leaves are, and they do look lacy, the kind of, what they leave behind. I'm just wondering if you know what that is.
Where are you located?
In Sheboygan.
Okay.
Right near the lake.
Yeah, because it's lacy. It's not the only insect that makes lacy, but I start with Japanese beetles. But after that, I do have various little caterpillars that can cause lacy feeding. Some of them are camouflaged quite well, but usually if you turn the leaves over and start poking around, you'll see little half-inch little green worms.
I don't even know if I've ever seen a Japanese beetle. How big are they? What do they look like?
They're about the size of your little fingernail, or at least my little fingernail, mm-hmm. and bright, kind of shiny green metallic body with brown wing covers and little white dots along the side of the body. They're really, as a single beetle, very attractive. When you got 150 of them on a rose flower, they're not so pretty.
No. There you go, Josie.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. I want to go back to Facebook for a minute just because there's the coolest picture here, photo from Joyce. This beehive is stuck to my bedroom window. So they made the beehive on part of the window, and so you can see the interior
mm-hmm.
of the hive through the window. They're choosing to leave it there.
But that's a paper wasp.
Yeah, they're wondering, is there any problem with leaving it there? I don't think so.
No. In fact, what they will watch. What happens to paper wasps is they really starve to death. Because as we get late in the summer, there's no food to feed the young, unlike honeybees that store honey as their food source to get through the winter. And so that's why I can guarantee people they're done by the 1st of November, and they don't come back. That's probably an adaptation because of diseases. If there was a disease in the nest and the new queen came back, even though she wouldn't have to work so hard because the nest is already made, there's a chance of picking up diseases. So they start everything from scratch each year. And so... it will continue to go. You'll be able to see the individual cells. You'll probably be able to see the workers in there busy feeding the young, caring for the young, because the maggot-like grub is totally helpless. Without the aid of the adult wasps, they would not survive.
Very cool. Mary in New Berlin. Hi, Mary. Thanks for calling.
I've been plagued. Good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I've been plagued with carpenter bees this year. I never knew about carpenter bees. I live in a timber frame home, so it's very unsettling.
Mm-hmm.
Where do they live? Where do they come from? And what's an antidote?
Well, the true carpenter bees are becoming more common in the state. This is another one of these things that the lack of cold weather is allowing, because I usually think of carpenter bees as being more of a southern creature, but definitely there's strong evidence that they're quite active in the southern third of the state. They will typically nest in wood that is starting to get soft, and they will construct chambers. And they're like a bumblebee. They go out and collect pollen and whatnot, but they're digging into the wood will cause, I don't say major structural damage, but major cosmetic damage. So typically what's done is if you start to see activity, you've got one or two options. You replace it with a sounder piece of wood, or if they're going into something, you use a dust, and you dust up in the area. When they come and go, they will be done in.
In short order. Mary, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Phil, always a pleasure.
Nice to be here.
You'll be back in a month or so.
And I bet you my bugs will still be active.
I bet they will, too. Phil Pelletieri, UW Extension Entomologist, our guest today, heads the UW-Madison Insect Diagnostic Lab. He'll be back. We'll do it again. Tomorrow at 11, we'll hear about this year's Wisconsin Sheep and Wool Festival and talk about raising sheep in Wisconsin. Then at 11:45, we'll visit with the author of Sweet Corn Spectacular. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.